evening, everybody. Can I welcome everyone here tonight? My name is Tony Giddens, Director of the LSE. Will you forgive me, before we get into the more formal part of the evening, just to mention a few questions on issues on procedure? Professor Galbraith's lecture is going to be the first main event, of course. Then there'll be an opportunity for asking questions, but these questions should be written on cards which are available by everybody's seat. If you're watching in a video link out there, you can still submit questions the same way. After the ceremony will then follow, the conferring of the honorary degree after the questions, and I hope that everyone will stay for that important event. And after that, there will be a reception in both bars of the Peacock Theatre, to which everyone here, and I presume everyone in the video link room, is also invited. Well, I have much pleasure in welcoming to the school today Professor John Kenneth Galbraith. Professor Galbraith is internationally known for his development of Keynesian and post-Keynesian economics, the economics of the modern large firm, as well as for his writing and his active involvement in the public sphere. He has had a long and distinguished career in American and international politics. He served under President John F. Kennedy as ambassador to India from 1961 to 1963. Under President Franklin D. Roosevelt, he worked in the Office of Price Administration in the early 1940s, where he organized and administered the wartime system of price controls. For his public service, he was awarded the Medal of Freedom in 1946. Professor Galbraith has campaigned with Adlai Stevenson in 1952-56 and was an economic advisor to John F. Kennedy during the 1960 presidential race. As chair of Americans for Democratic Action, he supported Senator Eugene McCarthy's bid for the presidency, helping to put his name in nomination at the Democratic Convention in 1968. Professor Galbraith has written numerous books and articles and is known for his lucid and persuasive writing style. The Affluent Society, published in 1958, which introduced a new phrase into the language, won him many awards and accolades. His New Industrial State, Economics and the Public Purpose, became equally well known. His other works include American Capitalism, 1952, The Great Crash, published in 1955, Economics and the Art of Controversy, also published in the same year, and The Liberal Hour, published in 1960. He has written on a wide number of subjects, on Indian art, modern urban planning and design, civil rights, American foreign policy, and he's also written a novel, The Triumph, published in 1968. He has, as always, a new book that has just appeared, which is called Name Dropping from FDR On. I'm sure he'll be dropping a few names here tonight. He was also BBC Reith Lecturer in 1966. Professor Galbraith is a notable defender of liberal values in a world where they seem widely challenged. It is a great honour to have him here back at the LSE with us this evening. The title of Professor Galbraith's lecture is, and it is a great title, In the New Century, The Unfinished Business of the Old. I give you Professor John Kenneth Galbraith.
May I thank you for that admirable introduction, all true, wonderfully understated. Everybody on an occasion of this sort should take full advantage in his vanity of the pleasures of the moment, and I do. 62 years ago, Catherine Atwater and I, newly married, she joins me here tonight, spent a year in Cambridge, this Cambridge. It was then in the high pulse of the Keynesian Revolution. Economic discussion was in constant, intense, but London also called. Once a week, we came up here to seminars at LSE. A major attraction of those seminars was that of Friedrich von Hayek, who, however, was only slightly heard. The 2 hours of the seminar were given over all but exclusively to telling him he was wrong. I found myself in support of this correction. It was education by the rebuke of error. I trust that this is not a tendency on this pleasant and, for me, nostalgic occasion. Over the years, I must tell you, I've often presented myself to ardent conservatives as a student of Hayek. It has added in an agreeable way to their normal confusion. In later years, I must tell you, however, that Hayek and I became good friends, although I did not follow him on that somewhat uncertain road, I'm happy to call it, that road to serfdom. My subject this evening is the unfinished business of the century, and needless to say, the millennium. We have had frequent word, particularly in the United States, of the achievements of the past century. More is needed on the achievements and the needs of the future. There is much to be said on this, and fears that you may harbor as to the possible length of this lecture could be well founded. But I will do my best to abbreviate and allow time for your questions, and in the LSE tradition, for your disenchantment. I'm sorry, I meant to say disagreement. Much in the last century has indeed been accomplished. In what we choose to call the advanced countries, there has been an enormous change in the basic substance of life, particularly in the production of food, shelter, clothing, other manufactured artifacts, provision of health care, and in the means of communication and transportation. I began my life, as Lord Rolle is well aware, in economics with the study of agriculture. At that time, just under half of all those gainfully employed in the United States were in the production of food, tobacco, and cotton. As for centuries before, most had been so occupied. Now, fewer than 5% of our working force is thus engaged. In this century, men and women have escaped the repetitive, often dismal exertion that kept people fed and clothed. The amenities of rural life were always greatly praised. It was praise partly designed to conceal the lonely, miserable effort often involved. I was born and reared on a farm in Canada. I identify my early life as a British subject. Yet to this day, I never awaken in the morning without a sense of satisfaction that I will not have to spend the next hours in that monotonous but richly commended toil in agriculture. One of the achievements of the century has been the general escape from what Marx, no doubt with some exaggeration, called the idiocy of rural life. We have also seen a wonderful lengthening of the years of health, and I trust enjoyment of life. Being alive and in good health surely enlarges the aggregate of human enjoyment. And there are also practical effects. If at the beginning of the century I were speaking to you now, as I do tonight, at my age, it would be from the next world. Some of you, I hope, would be there as well. Others, still here, would happily have escaped this lecture. We have also the much celebrated technological supplements to human intelligence, including the much discussed computer world. This, in some aspects, is serviceable and good, in others, contrived and diversionary. Still, there can be no doubt that greater equality in mental achievement has come from the technological advance of this past century, but far less, of course, than has come from the London School of Economics. More important, there has been a general escape from the worst feature of modern existence, something to which I have already alluded. That is hard, tedious, boring toil. This has not yet been eliminated, but one of the great accomplishments of the century has been the reduction in the proportion of people so engaged. In this connection, we must note, and seriously note, that the word work is our most misleading social term. It designates the occupation of those who would be very unhappy without it, including many to whom I speak here tonight. And we use the same word for hard, repetitive, even physically painful toil. No word in the English language stretches over such different conditions. There is a further perverse fact that those who most enjoy what is called work are those who are best paid, and they are also allowed the most leisure. The most enduring American social classic of the 19th century, coming just at the century's end, was Thorstein Veblen's The Theory of the Leisure Class. It assumed almost without argument that if rich enough, you, and certainly your dependents, did not need to work. There is a present effect. Over the 60 years I've been teaching at Harvard, I have often, while crossing Harvard Yard, been stopped by one of my colleagues with the question, "Aren't you working a bit too hard?" Leisure is essential for the affluent, and also for those of us for whom work is pleasant, relaxing, mentally rewarding. For those who must truly toil, however, leisure is an escape from social virtue. Nevertheless, here too, there has been progress. In the century past, many have graduated from the miseries to the enjoyments of work. That more can do so is a major hope for the time ahead. I turn now to urge a more discriminating scrutiny of what is considered the greatest achievement of the last century. That is economic success and therefore the way we measure it. Of the economic success, to which I have already adverted, there is no doubt. In the fortunate countries, there has been an enormous increase, as I have said, in the production of goods and services, the wherewithal of life. The measure of the increase, the annual increase in gross domestic product, has become the prime indicator of all human progress. I do not suggest an increase in GDP and its measurement is unimportant. Our debt to my well-loved colleague at Harvard, Simon Kuznets, who first measured GNP for a wide audience, as it once, gross national product as it once was, our debt is very great. But there are limits. This summer, thousands of visitors will descend on Florence, Italy. By all modern standards, in its greatest days, those we still celebrate, it was a city of small, even insignificant income. If I may come closer to home, William Shakespeare was of a country with a very low gross domestic product. Paris, in the years of the Impressionists, was appreciably less affluent than it is now. So also was the world that gave us Charles Darwin, and no one since has so challenged embodied belief. Success as measured by economic output bears no close relationship to human achievement. The most ardent artistic effort is now devoted not to the arts, but to promoting the sale of goods and services. And so also most of our scientific effort. Darwin's successors now concentrate heavily on getting new products for the market. If the history of arts and of science gives us pause as to the measures of present achievement, there are also problems within economics as well. The most serious is the ancient and unsolved problem of instability, of the enduring sequence of boom and bust. That history goes back for centuries to the Tulipomania in Holland in 1637, and perhaps before, to the early 18th century promise in Paris of gold in Louisiana, gold that has not yet been discovered. And it goes back here to the South Sea bubble. And in later years, there was here in London the wonderful prospect for draining the Red Sea to recover the treasury left behind at the crossing of the Israelites. In the last century in the United States, about every 30 years, there was a sequence of boom and bust, including the great crash of 1929. I might depart from my notes to say that I wrote a book on that subject, The Great Crash, and while I was proud to hear you recite the names of my books, that book to this day sells more than all my others combined. And nothing so helps it as the recurrent periods of economic nervousness. It also taught me, if I may digress for still one more moment, the importance of naming books properly. In those days, it was briefly on the bestseller list. I was often in New York, and then the old New York airport, as you remember, there was a bookstore just as one came down to the plains. And I always looked in that bookstore to see if the book was there, and it never was. And one night I had some extra time, and I wandered into the bookstore, looked around, until the lady in charge couldn't help noticing me, and she said, Are you looking for something special? And I was ashamed of myself. Here, an academic person looking for his own book. But she had me. So I had to relax and say, well, I forget the author's name. But then I came in strong. I remember the title of the book. It was called The Great Crash. She looked at me solemnly, wiped a tear from her eye, and said, not a title you could sell in an airport. So I said, in the United States, we are now having another exercise in speculative optimism following the partial reversal last year. We have far more people selling derivatives, index funds, and mutual funds, as we call them, your unit funds, than there is intelligence for the task. I am cautious about prediction. I years ago discovered that my correct predictions are soon forgotten, my others meticulously recalled. But some things are definite. When you hear it being said, as we hear it being said every day in New York, that we've entered a new era of permanent prosperity with prices of financial instruments reflecting that happy fact, you should, Mr. Director, take cover. This has been the standard justification of speculative excess for several centuries, for a good part of the millennium. My one-time Harvard colleague, Joseph Schumpeter, thought inevitable and even beneficial what he called these episodes of creative destruction. That was his phrase, creative destruction. The cyclical process by which the system eliminates the people and the institutions which are mentally too vulnerable for useful economic service. Something which possibly could arouse attention today on Wall Street. Unfortunately, this process, which Schumpeter found so useful, has larger and less benign effects, including the possibility of painful recession or depression. Let us not assume that the age of slump, recession, depression is past. Let us have both the needed warnings against speculative excess and awareness that the succeeding situation, the succeeding slump, can be painful. And there will then be need for the specific remedial action by which the government eases the pain. Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, one regularly reads, is now out of fashion. Let us bear in mind that his is a cyclical legacy that fades in good times, returns with recession. So others who accept government action as a necessary stabilizing force. I come now to two pieces of unfinished business of the century and millennium that have high visibility and urgency. The first is the very large number of the very poor, even in the richest of countries, and I regret to say, notably in the United States. Once our impoverished were scattered over the countryside, especially in the rural South. Now everywhere they are in our great cities, melding in with the larger urban mass. In the fortunate lands, urban poverty, remains the most evident and painful of the economic and social legacies from the centuries past. the answer, or part of the answer, and I speak in a country that has given leadership in this matter, is rather clear. Everybody should be guaranteed a decent basic income. A rich country such as the United States can well afford to keep everybody out of poverty. Some, it will be said, will seize upon this income and want work. So it is now with more limited welfare, as it is called. I've already discussed the issue of leisure and work. Let us accept some resort to leisure by the poor as well as by the rich. There is more in the modern economic system, and especially in the United States. We have a bizarre problem in the distribution of income. A heavy concentration of in the very top income brackets, much less to those below, and especially those at the bottom. There is now a stirring discussion of inequality. I would like to see it intensified. When it is said, as it is, that we should protect the income of the rich, reduce taxes in order to encourage effort, when I hear that, I have an answer. Perhaps we should have a higher marginal rate of taxation to stimulate effort by the rich to maintain after-tax income. This is not widely applauded. I haven't noticed any vigorous response here tonight. I yield to the possibly unfortunate future of this recommendation, but the equalizing effect of taxation must in our countries be strongly defended. Inequality, poverty, has also its grave international dimension. As we look at the achievements of the century just passed, we must all pay tribute, and especially here in Britain, to the end of colonialism. Too often, however, the end of colonial rule has also meant the end of effective government. Particularly in Africa, colonialism has frequently given way to corrupt government or no government at all. Nothing so ensures hardship, poverty, and suffering as the absence of a responsible, effective, honest polity. Once this was a result from the earlier escape from colonialism in Latin America, so now, as I say, in much of Africa, and in lesser measure in some of Asia. In a humane world order, we must have a mechanism to suspend sovereignty when this is necessary to protect against human suffering and disaster. Let there be government by the United Nations to bring about an effective and humane independence. Economic aid is important, but without honest, competent government, economic aid is of little consequence. We have here one of the major unfinished tasks of the century and the millennium. My emphasis, I hope you will all have observed, is on the United Nations. I believe it should have had the dominant role in the recent tragedy in the Balkans. I am also far from enthusiastic about air power as they're used. A matter on which, oddly enough, I claim a major experience. If I might enter a personal note, I was extensively in charge of assessing the effect of the economic effects of the air tax after World War II. There was nothing to be said for the Serbian rule of Kosovo. but neither for the basically indiscriminate nature of bombing of men, women, children, and one should add, a foreign embassy. There is one more piece of unfinished business. Many of you in this audience give lectures. Always put in that wonderful note that it may be coming to an end. There is one more piece of unfinished business. In the United States, in our foreign policy, we have a rigorous control of action, not by thought, but by acceptance of the past. This keeps us from accommodating our foreign policy to the realities of the world scene. Some Cuban migrants apart, no one defends our policies toward Cuba. Yet under the tyranny of what is called accepted policy, we continue an embargo on trade and a partial embargo on other communication that makes no sense whatever. Our greatest achievement, of that last year was lifting the embargo on baseball. But this is a detail. There is a far more serious legacy of the last 100 years, and particularly of the last 50 years. It is on our position on the edge, on the edge of a total end to civilized existence on the planet, perhaps of life itself. Available are the nuclear weapons which could do precisely this. And there is a strong commitment to keeping and protecting these weapons, even though we fully realize the threat. As long as we accept them in the nuclear countries, and particularly in my country, we are limited in our ability to persuade others to a policy of sanity and survival. When India and Pakistan last year exploded nuclear weaponry, we in the United States reacted adversely. There was an inevitable and natural answer. What about you? Thus, the greatest unfinished business of the century, now ending, is the need to eliminate this weaponry. It need only to fall into the hands of mentally vulnerable politicians to bring a nuclear exchange, which, to repeat, could be the end of all civilized existence, and quite possibly of all existence. This weaponry and its threat is the most serious legacy of the century just ending. The most urgent task now, and of the new century, is to bring to an end the threat of Armageddon, something on which there has been much solemn comment over the centuries, and which is now a reality. With that glowing thought, I now put myself in your hands. Thank you very much. Can I stand up?
Well, we now should have these questions wending their way forward. Well, I think we probably need the written questions, actually, because that was the system. But maybe to start things off, could I ask a question while the questions are coming forward? Mm-hmm. Was the rediscovery of Hayek then in the 70s and 80s a complete mistake?
Pardon?
Was the rediscovery of Hayek in the 70s and 80s a complete mistake? And if not, why did it happen? If it was a complete mistake, why did it happen? I have to give you back the mic.
There's an easy answer to that question. Was the discovery, the rediscovery of Hayek in later times a mistake? There's an easy answer, by all means. The broad tendency, as people become more affluent, if I may coin that phrase, and I want to say a word about that in a moment, is to relate the achievement to themselves, not to the state. But the problem associated with affluence continue to be very great. And the notion that we can escape those problems is quite wrong. And that was the very central to the case of my old friend Friedrich Hayek. I use the word friend deliberately. We became very good friends in later years. He saw this as an endless trip down to restriction, restraint on the individual, and he was, I'm sorry to tell you, quite wrong.
Shall I read these out?
I'm just going to, unless you want to read them directly.
You read it.
The question goes, re the equalizing effects of taxation. To what extent does this depend upon the restriction of exit option on the part of the wealthy, e.g. exiting from moving productive efforts overseas? In other words, taking all their assets into shelters and so forth. Tax avoidance on the part of the wealthy, what role does that play in sustaining global inequality?
Can the rich put it in quite slightly less formidable language? Can they escape taxation by moving to another country, particularly to what were once the British West Indies? To some extent, but that is not serious. And we can always hope that diplomacy, other forms of pressure, will restrain those countries that provide such an escape. And anyway, the number of people who prefer residence in some obscure island in the Caribbean to London or New York, those who prefer that, we can dispense with them. We don't need them.
If poverty is to be eliminated in developed countries, is it necessary to restrict immigration?
That is, immigration to the fortunate countries? By no means. The refreshing effect of immigration, of which I am an example, is something we should all support. And I have long been an advocate in the United States of a liberal immigration policy, not only for the benefit of the immigrants, but for the enormous resource that we have found in that immigration at all levels of human endeavor. So, I have to say, bluntly, I am in favor of the most liberal possible immigration policy by the advanced countries. Where would Britain be without the intellectual qualities of people that it's brought from overseas?
Very true.
I've got lots of Billy Doos here, so I'm going to have to give most of them to Professor Galbraith to take home and read on the plane. Can I just give you one quick question about the impact of globalization? which you did not mention, the questioner says, will the impact of globalization be beneficial for the division between the poor and the rich countries?
Let me make one general comment with force. I am a member of the committee, the advisory committee on English usage to the American Heritage Dictionary. And I have personally a lot resisted any legitimate acceptance of the word globalization. And here, at the home of the English language, I request your urgent support. I accept closer trade relations, closer cultural relations, closer personal travel relations between countries as a good thing, as something we should encourage, as an escape from the venomous nationalism of the past, from which I need not remind anybody here of the cost. And therefore, having said that, I would like to stand generally in favor of all forms of closer global association, even though there may at times be some painful results, some unemployment. Let us have that in light instead of the larger dangers, the larger mental and cultural restrictions of narrow nationalism.
Can I just thank everyone who's sent in these questions? They're far, far, far too many for Professor Galbraith to answer, or for any human being to answer. So I think we should now take the last question, because we have to proceed to the major event of the evening, the ceremonial. Can I just ask one last question, which I'm sure you'll have a pretty incisive answer for? Is there an economic bubble in the United States? And if so, when will it burst?
Well, I've already indicated such answer as I have to that. We are having, there should be no doubt about it, an episode of speculation in the United States, to some extent here in Europe, but especially in Wall Street, as to how, when that bubble will burst, what the effect will be. There are times when you should end a lecture even of this depth, even of this perception, by saying, I don't know. But I said earlier in my comments that when we read in the papers and hear it said on television that we have entered a new era of permanent prosperity, let us be aware that that has been said every 15 or 20 years in all the history of the economic system. And let us not be entirely ignorant of history. Thank you very much.
I now call upon Lord Rolle.
Director, ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to present John Kenneth Galbraith, Professor Emeritus at Harvard University, for the award of an honorary degree. This will not be a traditional oration in Latin, I assure you, I shall speak in English, the language which our honorary graduate handles with such consummate skill and grace, as you will have observed even this evening. I am particularly delighted and honored to have been given this opportunity, not only because of the eminence of our graduate, but because I've had the good fortune for just on 60 years to have been a close friend of Ken Galbraith's. When we first met in Princeton, actually, he'd just left Harvard for a brief spell at Princeton in 1939, and I've known him ever since and been together with him many, many times. This ceremony should have been held towards the end of last year. It would then have been in the wake of his 90th birthday on the 15th of October. But he was indisposed and his doctors wouldn't let him fly, so that occasion had to be postponed, and we are delighted that it can take place today with him fully restored, as you will have noticed. Ken Galbraith is first and foremost an eminent academic. I know of no one this century in his own field of study whose name and work are so widely known all over the world, and not by academic specialists alone, other than Keynes, whom he mentioned earlier. His 90th birthday last year was the occasion not only of an enormous concourse of the great and the good in the United States, but it was celebrated by very many people of all kinds in many countries of the world. He has taught numerous generations of students, mainly at Harvard, but not only at Harvard. He's written an enormous number of books and articles. He has been an administrator running the American price control during the Second World War. He has been a journalist briefly as an editor of Fortune magazine. And he has been a diplomatist as American ambassador to India. He is regarded as an outstanding economist. Of course he's that. But if I may say so, he's not the ordinary kind of economist as that word is, I believe, unfortunately so often understood today. He has not fallen for the temptations of those facile fashions that are so frequent in economics today and that parade under the name of science, in a vain attempt, in my opinion, to approximate economics to the exact sciences. His economics, I venture to think, is that of the great masters of political economy of the last 200 years. And his name can safely be mentioned in the company of Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, Alfred Marshall, and in our own day, John Maynard Keynes. And I may say also that this Canadian Scot in the United States has a great deal of intellectual affinity to that Scandinavian Midwesterner whom he mentioned, Thorstein Veblen, the great social analyst and critic whom he has mentioned tonight and about whom he has written. In his economics, I think he has produced an output which is truly remarkable. And I believe that he has obeyed the injunction of the old Latin writer who said, not a day shall pass without a line. Whenever I am in 30 Francis Avenue in his house, he's always to be found in the study writing something. Never a day passes without a line. And I think his brief experience of journalism has given him, or enhanced in him, the gift of speedy and incisive writing. And as he himself has said, his early interest in agricultural economics, rooted in a family background, has oriented his subsequent research and studies into direction which inevitably involve social and political elements and not merely the deductive analysis of pure or so-called pure economics. I was going to mention his books. The director has already mentioned an early, highly successful one, The Affluent Society, which this year, or was it last year, celebrated its 40th anniversary. I was also going to mention to you The Great Crash, but he's already stolen my one and only joke about the Affluent. Actually, I was present on one occasion when he tried this experiment, with the result that he recounted to you today. But that book is still eagerly sought at the slightest tremor in financial markets, which are certainly not infrequent these days. He has, as I said, escaped the temptations to seek science in the exact science term of the word. Nor has he fallen, as far as I'm aware, for the temptation, either in theory or in practice, to run hedge funds, an area which is not shunned by other so-called economic scientists. If I may mention one little anecdote, when I discovered, and it was widely reported, that Mr. Merriweather, the head of long-term capital management, which got into trouble a year or so ago, was assisted by two Nobel Prize winners, I telephoned a friend of mine in the United States, who was, I believe, the first American Nobel laureate, and I said, do you know these two guys? Oh, yes, he said, one of them was a pupil of mine. So I said, so you're a responsible part of this. Have you put any of your own money in it? Oh, no, he says, I don't invest in computers. He has been extraordinarily successful in every one of his literary enterprises. I think it can be said of him, as Dr. Johnson said of Oliver Goldsmith, he hasn't touched anything that he didn't adore. Nor is wit and the light touch lacking. As you may see, for example, in a recent book of his, Letters to J.F. Kennedy, or it is just published, as the director mentioned, Name Dropping, which is highly entertaining and which I thoroughly recommend to you. He has been given many awards, prizes, honors, and an extraordinarily large number of honorary doctorates in many universities in the world. But I venture to think, Director, that the school, in honoring itself by making this award to him today, is according him a particularly appropriate recognition, not just because of his long association with the school, where he's lectured many times, but above all because the school, like Ken Galbraith, has always taken the whole range of social studies as they illuminate the human condition for his parish and for its parish. Director, I request you, in the name of the Court of Governors, to admit John Kenneth Galbraith to the degree of Doctor in Science, Economics, Honoris Causa.
Ladies and gentlemen, it only remains for me to thank everyone for coming this evening. This is J.K. Galbraith's, I believe, 46th honorary degree. There is something in economics called diminishing returns, but we hope these returns have not diminished as yet. It's also wonderful to have a lecture from a scholar fast approaching the peak of his productive powers.
May I leave you in no doubt as to my pleasure. I have been aspiring all these years to an honorary degree from the London School of Economics, and now I have it. And you see me, in spite of my deeply ingrained modesty and my faithful acceptance of everything Lord Rolls said, to be nonetheless extremely happy, and not least in having such a wonderful audience. Thank you.